Good morning, everybody. Thank you again for coming in on this very, very chilly day. It is 8:16, and we are calling the Workforce, Labor, and Economic Development, Finance, and Policy Committee meeting to order. I see that we have a quorum, and I want to ask Lead Pinto if you've had a chance to look over the notes from our yesterday's meeting and to see if we can have a motion to approve the minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had not, but I have now, and I do. And Mr. Chair, I do suggest that the minutes be approved. Although a reminder that I cannot, cannot.
I think you're sort of that extra piece I keep forgetting about.
Thank you. It was very, very, very respectful and kind of you to be sending it my way. And unfortunately, I can't. I can't do my part.
If I could, I'll ask Representative Berg if she's had a chance to review the minutes, and if we could get a legitimate motion for the minutes, Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll do all the work.
Thank you so much.
The minutes look good, and I move to accept them.
Thank you so much. Members, a motion has been made to approve the minutes as presented. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes have been approved as presented. Thank you very much. Members, today we've got two items on our calendar. We have a bill from Representative Kosnick, who will be taking up the first item today, House File 261. So, Representative Kosnick, if you want to make your way to the testifying table, I appreciate that. Also, members, just a reminder today, we have a hard stop at 9:45. We've got to do some training outside of this today, so we do have a hard stop. Our second item today is the presentation of Deed to talk about kind of their technology update, where are things at. So we'll spend some time on that, and there likely could be a lot of questions on that. And if we run into some issues with timing, members, I don't plan on coming back tonight, but we will pick up more questions at a future hearing. So just want to kind of set the stage for, we're not going to push you, we want plenty of time for those kind of questions, but we don't plan on going back tonight. So we'll just see how that goes, but at 9:45, we will be adjourning out at that moment. So members, with that, we will proceed with House File 261. Representative Kosnick, welcome to the committee, and please proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Chair Baker and members. Lead Pinto, this is House File 261. It builds off of a pilot program that we did 2 years ago with the generosity of this committee and the legislature. What it does is provides equine experimental health therapy for first responders. In this second go at it, we are adding active or retired police officers, full-time firefighters and volunteer firefighters, ambulance service personnel, 911 communicators, and correctional officers. From the first pilot that we did, there were retired members of that class that were not able to qualify under the pilot. And then also some of the other first responders were not eligible as well. But I think most importantly is that this program and this type of therapy has proven to be very successful for first responders and the unique traumas and significant traumas that they experience. And through this, the reporting in this bill and the previous bill, we have a 98% retention rate of keeping first responders working in their departments and in their profession. I have two testifiers with us that can explain a little bit more about the program. So I'll turn it back to you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick. I'm not sure which testifier will go first. Is it Ms. Mixon? Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, sir. I'm Sally Mixon. I'm the founder of...
Yeah, just pull the microphones in. We got to kind of eat them in this room. So thank you.
I'm Sally Mixon. I'm the founder of Abijah's. As Representative Kosnick shared, yes, we have a 98% success rate, and success rate in our eyes is first responders remaining in their job. Something that's really exciting, though, is we did have an officer who started coming to us who was retired, so he wasn't under the bill, and he actually, after a year and a half to 2 years of working with us, he just had his first day back at the department that he retired from, which was so cool and amazing to see. So came to his session yesterday and was excited and shared, you know, all about all about that. So it's an incredible program. I mean, somebody that believes wholeheartedly, I've been doing this work for over a decade. To see numbers like that was surprising. I was like, whoa, this is awesome. And so just so incredibly grateful for y'all backing this and supporting this. I'm excited for you to hear Nick's story. Nick is one of many that we see weekly, and it's just been an incredible experience. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mixon. Next up is Officer Jacobson. Welcome to the committee. We're grateful for you and your service. Thank you for coming this morning, and please proceed with your testimony after you announce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nick Jacobson. I'm a current Lakeville police officer. I have been for about 11 years, just over 11 years. Just a brief history of myself, out of high school, joining the Marine Corps Infantry, deployed a few times to Afghanistan, about 2 years total. During that time, went through quite a bit of combat, lost over half my squad, killed in action, more wounded in action, dismembered, that type of thing. My transition out of the Marine Corps and back into civilian life, I would say, was harder than expected. I always felt like I was here, never really present, never really actually left Afghanistan. I was trying to find a way to get back, not just maybe there, but to any fight where I felt like I belonged. After many attempts at different forms of therapy through the government, VA, or private practices, I decided that I wasn't something that could be fixed, and just kind of tried to hide who I really was and tried to find a reason after a while just to get back into the fight, like I said. Recently, a friend of mine who's a Navy SEAL commander noticed who I actually was, pulled me aside, and gave me the information to Abijah's. He told me it was an equine therapy. He said he uses it with himself and his team members and has seen great success. I begrudgingly took the information, spoke with Sally, and met her on my first session with the Abijah's. And one thing that sticks with me that I'll never forget is she said that you can always lie to us as therapists, but you can never lie to the horses. And that is so true. To understand it fully, I just believe each and every one of you would have to experience it firsthand and in person. Ever since I started with Abijah's and with Sally, I've noticed an amazing transition in my life, being more present as a father, a husband, and just a general police officer. My care for going back to combat is decreasing daily. I'm just enjoying life more and more, and it's all thanks to Abijah's and Sally.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Any other comments, Representative Koznick, before we go to members?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just say that healthier officers, healthier first responders means that we have safer communities and the responses that they do. I'm grateful that I just stumbled upon this program through a constituent as I was out visiting Canterbury Park and looking at the races. And like I said, helping feed or anything with the horses like that. It's actual clinical therapy and utilizing the intuitiveness of the horses to bring out the issues with our first responders. And because the program was in place, and unfortunately, but fortunately, you know, there's tragedy that they face every day, but fortunately, because we had this program in place, we just came upon the one-year anniversary of that horrible tragedy in Burnsville. One of the first calls of the Burnsville Police Department and the Lakeville Police Department next door that I represent was to provide support for all those first responders that were involved in that. And so very glad that that was in place. And again, the 98% retention, you could imagine there are a lot of questioning of if that's the right profession for you. And we know that we are struggling with workforce all over. That's what the committee's charges, but specifically one of the main things that we do as government is provide for the safety of our community, and this is one way that we can continue to help that workforce shortage in this community, and so grateful for this program to help not just the Lakeville Police Department, but police departments, sheriff's departments, first responders all across the state, really, and they've got the numbers in the reports to show that as well if they if you have some questions about that. But I appreciate the committee's time this morning and the work that you do. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick. And again, I want to thank Ms. Mixon for this doing this program. It sounds amazing. My question, and I'll switch over to members, how long has this been going, and have you received funding from the state in this committee before this?
Thank you, Chair. This program has been going on for over 10 years now. I started Abijah's about 10 years ago. I brought it to Canterbury Park in 2021 to really hone in on the thoroughbreds. I'm an exercise jockey as well, so the thoroughbreds have a lot in common with first responders. They don't want to slow down until they break down, those types of things. So I just saw this really unique parallel and wanted to just go after this population and be really not just good but great at it. And so that's when we shifted to Canterbury and just solely started focusing on that. And I can't remember your last question.
Ms. Mixon, have you received support from the state before in the prior years?
Last session, sir, we did. The bill was similar, but it didn't. It only did active duty, active police and fire.
I see.
And so we as an organization continued to see all first responders through our donors. You know, we want to keep building this and growing this. It eventually goes statewide and help other help other places do this. So with this other cop coming, retired cop going back into service, it was just like, we've got to, like, this is amazing. And if we can spread that over into the retired, maybe they won't be first responders anymore, but they'll be healthy citizens, you know, giving back. And so that's the goal, the hope.
Thank you for that. Representative Lesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Kosnick, for bringing this bill. Horses are healing, without a doubt. Having grown up on a farm, having the opportunity to ride every day, I can't say it any better than you did. And they are incredibly intuitive. And I'm so happy to see that you're expanding this program, because I've had many constituents in my district that work for 911 and dispatch that have been asking me, or emergency EMS on the ambulance, to have something for mental health, to help them decompress. And so the expansion of this program is going to help a lot of people in our state that deal with protecting us in the worst of times. So thank you. I'm glad it's being a beneficial program to so many. And thank you, Officer, for your service and for sharing the program. Wonderful.
Representative Bakeberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you, Sally. Thank you, Officer Jacobson, Representative Kosnick. This is something that is easy, in my opinion, for us to support. If you haven't had a chance to go out and visit Canterbury and talk with Sally, and you just got the tip of the iceberg of the passion that she has for the work that she's doing, but really her heart for serving first responders. And that's the piece that I took away. And I think one of the blessings that I have found in serving in this role is you're able to see the things that are happening within our community that are just amazing. And this is one of those things. You know, I don't represent Canterbury Park. It's just outside of my district, but it's obviously a big economic driver in our area. And I knew about Canterbury, but I didn't know about Abijah's and the amazing work that they are doing. And something that has Sally shared to me one of the first times we talked, and she said it again today, is Abijah's is supporting those who support us. And she said, you know, many of our first responders don't slow down until they break down. I think we just need to think about that for a little bit. And hearing Officer Jacobson's just honest, heartfelt testimony about his service to our country, losing his fellow soldiers, thank you. Thank you for your service. And I would just really challenge members, go out to Canterbury, set up a meeting with Sally, and you will walk away and just be encouraged by the amazing work that is happening to support those who support us. So thank you. I'm proud to support this.
Thank you very much. Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Kosnick, for advancing this, and Ms. Mixon, and then Officer Jacobson, thank you for your service to our country. And I'll note that that service has even continued today because you've shared some, I imagine, some pretty challenging things to share in this setting, but you're doing so on behalf of other folks, and so thank you so much for all that service. And I had heard this bill previously a couple times in the Public Safety Committee, and I'm trying to think through. We had heard a bill just yesterday in Public Safety, as it turns out, from a program called Hometown Hero Outdoors, which provides sort of outdoor experiences and mental health services for first responders. And maybe, I don't know if Ms. Mixon could just talk about kind of the interaction between the two programs, if at all. I assume you're familiar with them and just understand, which, and I do want to emphasize, I work as a prosecutor outside the legislature. Mental health and support for our first responders is just absolutely critical. So grateful for that and just sort of understanding the interaction. To Ms. Mixon, Mr. Chair, if you're willing.
To Ms. Mixon.
Ms. Mixon, yeah.
Thank you very much. Or
Representative Kosnick may know, but I suspect she's
Ms. Mixon.
The expert.
So Hometown Hero Outdoors, I learned about them a few years back, and they really specialize on the nature aspect, right? They started with veterans, I believe, and really taking veterans out into nature and how healing that can be and the camaraderie of it. They've also started working with first responders. I know Chris himself is a retired officer. And so as I got to talking with them, I was like, well, this is interesting because we actually we're doing clinical work and we're outside. I mean, horses are outside and we're in nature. And so that could be a really interesting partnership just from a referral standpoint. There's so many individuals that I see that I'm like, you know, the rapport, the camaraderie, they need their own herd. And so to send them to a place like Hometown Hero Outdoors, like, hey, like get to know a new herd, and then vice versa. You know, there's people that are really struggling. They go on trips and it kind of opens up a door of hurt and wounds. And so then they can refer them to us and we can go deeper, into that mental health aspect of it. So I thought it was a really cool opportunity. Like, yeah, you like outdoors. So do I. So.
Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, it sounds like maybe both organizations kind of, the two kind of having slightly different spots depending on the need of the person. And of course, we want to make sure we meet those needs. And I'd spoken briefly with the chair about this before, and Representative Kosnick and or Chair Kosnick and Chair Baker and I all started at the same time. Just thinking through the best path for this, I'll say that I'm wondering a little bit about whether it will end up being the best fit in this area, especially as it expands to retired law enforcement. I'm not saying that it wouldn't be. I'm just sort of trying to, it's early days yet. And I was wondering whether Chair Kosnick might consider, the bill had been heard previously in public safety, and one thought to consider at least might be to send it that in that direction just as an additional possible path for funding, which, and I will say as the lead on our side, I wouldn't see that as preventing funding here, but it's more sort of doubling the possible paths. I wouldn't force that issue today, maybe even something that wouldn't happen today, but maybe the chair and Chair Kosnick might want to bring it back up for that. But just sort of, I do wonder a little bit if it might fit, potentially end up fitting better on that side, depending, and we can obviously have conversations as we're putting together budgets, but might offer that to Chair Kosnick for consideration, especially, as I say, having just heard that other bill yesterday, that while different, is meeting first responder mental health needs, and it might fit a little bit better there than in the workforce development space for consideration.
Thank you, Lee Pinto. I think the plan for this is to lay it over in this committee at this point. I don't know if you've had a chance, Representative Kosnick, to talk about this with anybody in public safety at this point, but you may know the history better than I do, but any comments to Representative Pinto's comments?
Yep. Lead Pinto on committee, Chair Baker, when we first introduced the program 2 years ago, and again, this is without a lobbying group or anything, this is just me talking to a constituent and seeing a need, we did have a hearing in the public safety committee. There was a nice video, if you're not already sold on the program, that really was very touching. It was a firefighter in that case, talking about how he was suicidal, and because of the therapy, changed his outlook on that. Working with our Senate counterparts, they wanted to run it through the Workforce Development Program because they understood the need. And so we had a discussion with then Chair Mueller, and that was the path that was taken. And I think, again, with the astounding retention rate, the Workforce Development Fund is why we're back here. But certainly open to have further conversations. If you're suggesting belts and suspenders, I'm all for that too.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Representative Pete Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Baker, Representative Kosnick, Ms. Mixon, Officer Jacobson. I appreciate you guys bringing this issue forward. I've been a professional firefighter for 23 years, and one of the biggest challenges our members face is, and I'm sure it's the same for law enforcement, is getting the right coverage when you need it. Quite often, the therapists and the folks that our folks go to are not trained to deal with the issues that our folks are dealing with. I've had members that have finally reached the point to go talk to somebody only to get turned away after the first session because the therapist or the counselor that they were talking to did not have the skills to actually deal with the issues that they have. So we talked to, you talked a little bit about this being, you know, clinical coverage or clinical therapy. So is there a reason why I was poking around on your website last night a little bit this morning, Ms. Mixon, is there a reason why you guys don't try to access insurance coverage for this?
Ms. Mixon.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, one of the big reasons, my brothers are both in law enforcement, dad's a Marine, very good friends, firefighters, and throughout the years of serving this population, so many will not go to traditional therapy or any therapy for that matter because once, when there's insurance involved, because once there is, I as a clinician have to do a diagnostic assessment. And that means they're diagnosed with something. That puts up a big wall because that follows them into their career. They can become a liability, so to speak, if they're carrying a 9mm with PTSD. So a lot of them stop right away from even seeking therapy because they don't want that stigma. They don't want that diagnosis. And I don't blame them. I mean, as a mental health provider, diagnoses can be really tough to navigate and can affect you long term. So we've just taken the approach of let's tear down every barrier because these lives are so important. And let's fundraise our butts off to save as many lives as we can. So that's the approach we've taken.
Representative Johnson.
I appreciate that. Chair Baker, thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk a little bit more about this. I think that opens up a broader problem that we face here in Minnesota and across the country of how we treat our first responders when they do ask for help. Those are other bills that I think we should be working on so that when a member does go get help, they're given that pathway back. But I also think there is some concern with somebody not getting that diagnosis for the resources that that diagnosis may open up, whether that is a disability pension or a pension retirement, because there are certain cases where those folks shouldn't be carrying that 9mm and be on the streets, and it's important to identify those as well. And just one quick question, because Chair Baker had brought it up with one of the groups that presented yesterday about their 990 and things like that. After hearing that, I started looking up all the different groups that come through and just kind of perusing through some of those things. Are you guys a nonprofit with a 990, and where could we find that?
Our business person's coming.
Hi,
thank
my
you.
Name is
Please Dana introduce
Palmer.
Yourself. Yep.
I am the co-founder of Abijah's, and I work on the business development side. When we officially started, my partner, Ms. Mixon, has been doing this work for 10 years. And when we started in 2021 at Canterbury, we registered as a LLC, as a mental health service provider. We then partnered with a fiscal sponsor, 501c3, who had a mandate to support mental health through horses. And so for the first couple of years, we worked under their 501c3 umbrella. In 2024, we established our own 501c3 through the IRS, and we will be filing our first 990 this year. In the next month or two, and then we've also retained a new accounting firm that specializes in nonprofit accounting so that we can actually convert our entire process over into the nonprofit space.
Thank you very much, Representative Johnson, and thank you for bringing that up. I was planning on addressing that because I knew they were in a transitional period right now, so thank you for that. Anything further, Representative Johnson?
No, just one quick last thing. I do appreciate, like, especially from the folks sitting around this table, the sentiment for supporting our first responders. This is something, there's a lot of issues that we've been banging our heads on the table, from pensions to health insurance coverage to proper staffing levels and all those types of things. So I look forward to talking to each and every one of you about those issues. And just final thank you to the folks who brought this forward today.
Thank you. Final member question, Representative Hussein.
Representative Kosnick, first responder is critical, and the question that I have for you is, walk me through it. Like, is a doctor has a referral for, how do they seek for help for those officers? How do they determine that they need the service? Is it they call you guys, or and how long would take this training? Is it an hour, so they have to come back twice a week, or can you work us through the program, and what success numbers that you guys
Ms. Mason.
Have so far? Oh. And is there any, this program exists in any other states?
Ms. Mason.
I'm trying to figure out what one to answer to first. How they come to us, we've really taken the relationship approach. And so we build relationships with departments across the state, meeting with chiefs, meeting with peer support teams. And it's been truly a testament, most honoring thing that's ever happened with Abijah's is we've grown based on word of mouth, based on other first responders going back to their departments and saying, hey, you need to try this. And that's been incredibly humbling and honoring for that. When an individual comes, we assess their need. And so we offer weekly sessions. Some could come bi-weekly. And then we also do intensives because first responder schedules are, you know, all over the place. And so, for example, a year ago yesterday with Burnsville, we offered a handful of intensives. There's been some pretty awful incidences, you know, crime-related domestics that have been really difficult. And so we'll say, let's get you in here, whether it's for a half day, full day, and really get ahead of this. And so it's like 2 months of therapy in a day. And so we really work individually with kind of creating that treatment plan for that person and then also for that department, whatever their needs are, and coming alongside their peer support team or any other therapists that are already involved in that department. We're super collaborative. I love just expanding the herd, right? Like continuing to go and reach out. So does that answer? Did I miss anything?
I can speak to success rate since... Oh, sorry.
That's right. Go ahead. Your name again, please?
Danny Palmer.
Yes, Ms. Palmer, go ahead.
Thank you. We've seen 106 officers since the bill was passed in 2023, and we've received funding for 2 years, and 102 of those officers or firefighters are still active duty. Two of those that did so because of age, not because of other jobs-related stressors, and we've had, as Ms. Mixon shared earlier, we've had some of the retired first responders that we've worked with actually seek to re-enter the workforce as first responders over the last 2 years.
Thank you. Final comments, Representative Kosnick. We will be laying this bill over, so any closing comments?
Yeah, I appreciate the committee's time and consideration, the great questions. Don't want to take up too much more of your time. Representative Johnson, you brought up some great issues, and we've talked about some of the things with insurance and how we can better incorporate that. And Senator Pratt and I would welcome your thoughts and experience in that. I'll just say that, you know, one of the reasons Lakeville's so connected to this program is because when I was just touring and watching the horse races with a constituent, found out about this. As a nonprofit, they do outreach and well in ground into the law enforcement community, but they did and still do a lot of fundraising on their own I just thought this is an opportunity to address the workforce shortage on that. And so Lakeville fortunately has a public safety foundation to support different things that are not in the budget for the Lakeville police officers and first responders. And so I connected them with the Lakeville Rotary, the Lakeville Public Safety Foundation, the Lakeville Chamber to continue to support it. So it's not a Lakeville program. They don't even, they're close to Lakeville, but it's just something that was really welcomed in my district. But I think the additional support that we provide has proven itself to be extremely just a fantastic opportunity and needed service for first responders. And so I appreciate the additional consideration support, and we did broaden it a little bit to include the bigger breadth of first responders and not just law enforcement. I appreciate the time, Mr. Chair, and the committee, and if you have any questions as we continue to go forward, we're available for you.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick, and to the testifiers, great hearing this morning. House File 261 will be laid over for possible further inclusion, so thank you very much for coming in. Next up, members, we've got Deed coming to the testifying table. We'll let them get set up, and they've got a presentation. Welcome to the committee, and just proceed whenever you folks are ready. You guys know the drill. So, Mr. Rowe, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Chair Baker, and I'm joined this morning by a paid leave program director, Greg Norfleet.
Hi, Greg. Good morning.
Do a little bit of presentation. Just let me get set up with slides. I think they were shared with members in advance. All right. Okay.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As I said, I'm Evan Rome, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development, and we're here today. We've really been looking forward to this presentation, a little bit of an implementation update on paid leave program implementation progress. We're going to start with a brief intro to the paid leave program, since you know many members maybe were not here in the last biennium, just to provide a little bit of grounding around the program itself. We're going to talk about some of the early implementation actions that the program has delivered, and then we're going to talk a little bit about what's next for the rest of this calendar year in the run-up to January 1st, 2026. So just by way of introduction, since it may be helpful just to ground members in the overall contours of the paid leave program, the paid leave law enacted in May 2023 and updated in May 2024 makes paid family and medical leave coverage available to Minnesota workers beginning January 1st, 2026. The law provides job protections and partial wage replacement paid by the state to individuals who take leave for a qualifying condition, such as to bond with a new child or for medical care for themselves or their loved ones. The program will be funded by premiums made up of contributions from employees and employers. And as we look to how the program is going to be delivered, Minnesota is going to be the 13th state in the United States to implement a paid leave program. And we are leveraging other states and our own experiences to build an intuitive and accessible program that works. Based on lessons learned, we've already launched a wage detail in a system that employers already know and trust. We've drafted rules to support implementation of the statute, building on best practices from other states. We've worked with the Department of Commerce to create a viable market for equivalent plans. And we've built off of known user experience patterns to simplify engagement with the program, whether you're an employer or an employee. This is just a little graphic of what's covered under the paid leave law. There's two main buckets. We'd call it medical leave and family leave. Medical leave is leave to care for an individual's own serious medical condition. And then there's four types of leave that you might consider under family leave. There's bonding leave, which is leave to bond with an individual's child during the first 12 months after the child's birth or after the placement of the child through adoption or foster care. Active duty leave, so that's leave because a family member is on active duty or has been notified of an impending call to order to active duty in the armed services. Caring leave is leave to care for a family member with a serious health condition. And safety leave is leave because of domestic abuse, sexual assault, or stalking of the individual or the individual's family member. Within each individual type of leave, you can take between 1 to 12 weeks of leave. There's a maximum of 20 weeks under the law combined in 1 year if someone qualifies for both medical and family leave. And qualifying conditions must last more than 7 days and be certified by a healthcare provider or designated professional. Who paid leave covers? So covered employers are nearly all Minnesota employers, regardless of business size or number of employees. And covered employees are, you know, includes full-time, part-time, temporary, and most seasonal workers. But there are a few exceptions to that. Independent contractors and self-employed individuals are not automatically covered, but they may choose to opt into the law. And then certain seasonal hospitality employees are excluded if their employers choose to apply to the department for an exemption. Just in terms of the way that the payment structure works under the paid leave law, really paid leave is meant to help Minnesotans focus on what matters, whether that's caring for a child, recovering from an illness, or supporting a loved one. Minnesotans can get up to 90% of usual wages, up to a maximum of $1,372 per week. It's based on the statewide average weekly wage, so that's that would be the year for this year. But that'll be updated as we get closer to program launch. Lower wage workers, though, get more support. If you earn less, you get a higher percentage of your paycheck covered while you're on leave. And just as a base eligibility criterion, you must have earned at least 5.3% of the statewide average yearly wage in the past year to be eligible. And again, in 2024 numbers, that would be $3,781. There's also a component to the paid leave law that is related to job protections. Job protected leave, you know, I think the rationale here is job protected leave improves employee retention as workers can take the time they need to bond and care without having to choose between their job and their family. An employee who has taken family or medical leave must be restored to the same position or an equivalent position with the same pay, status, benefits, length of service, and seniority as prior to the date of leave. And then job protections for employees begin after 90 calendar days from the date of hire. And we're working in partnership with the Department of Labor and Industry, which has kind of enforcement authority over the job protections. So that's a very just quick synopsis, which hopefully is helpful to members. But want to get to the, you know, I think the real substance of the presentation, which is kind of the implementation update. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Director Norfleet to give a few updates, since his team is doing some great work here. So great.
Thank you, Mr. Rowe, and welcome to the committee. Mr. Fleet, introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Baker. My name is Greg Norfleet. I'm the director for the paid leave program here in Minnesota. I'm going to walk you through a few early deliverables or early implementation progress of what the last year has looked like and some major milestones that are on the way towards implementation in 2026. To start off with, our first major milestone is wage detail reporting. We launched wage detail reporting successfully in October of this last year, and we're already collecting wage detail information for over 160,000 employers across the state. That's a major milestone. It was quiet, but it does allow us to have the administrative data necessary to calculate financial eligibility as well as the benefit amounts once we go live. We're going to be using the same system, the unemployment insurance system UI online, to collect premiums as well when those go live in January of 2026. So the premiums under the program do go live in January 2026. And will be financed through payroll deductions on employee wages and contributions from employers. That first premium is due on April 30th, 2026, and we are on target to be able to take those funds in. The total premium rate will be separated between both a family and a medical leave premium rate. Employers can deduct up to 50% of the premiums from employee paychecks starting on January 1st, 2026. But employers may choose to pay some or more than that for some or all of their employees. And employers with under 30 employees with an average wage of less than 150% of the statewide are entitled to a reduced premium as well. We've also navigated a rulemaking process. The first round of rulemaking started early last year in January 2024 and lasted through the summer. During that time, we drafted rules on a wide variety of topics that you can see on the right side of the slide. And we held 19 virtual engagement sessions with over 950 attendees and generated over 600 unique comments. We took those comments in, and we published a second notice of intent to adopt the rules. That notice was published on November 28th of this last year through January 3rd. We received over 100 additional comments from 17 organizations through that posting. And we are now reviewing those comments and drafting or finalizing the rules, submitting them to the Office of Administrative Hearing. The timeline for the adoption is dependent upon their review. Our next major milestone that we're going to accomplish this year is equivalent plans. Under the statute, employers are able to offer these benefits themselves, either through a self-insured or a purchase plan. And we're working closely with our partners in the Department of Commerce to develop a straightforward process to evaluate these equivalent plans when they come in. We published initial guidance on our website at the end of last year, and we're planning on opening up for applications for equivalent plans early this spring. One note is that insurance carriers are already able to submit plans to Commerce for review. So when we do go live for applications, there will be private plans available for purchase for employers across the state. On our side, we are also developing a straightforward, user-friendly application for employers to apply for an equivalent plan exemption. Registered employers will be able to navigate to our site, apply for an exemption, upload plan documentation, and submit payment all in a single place. And as we mentioned, our plan is to go live with this early this spring. Throughout, those are kind of the major public-facing milestones, but we've been doing a lot of outreach as well. It's been really important to get out into Minnesota to understand the needs of our constituents. And we've been gathering input this whole time from businesses, organizations, and individuals in order to make paid leave work better. This is important because paid leave looks different depending on where you sit. In the past year, we've held over 150 engagement sessions with a variety of stakeholders. You can see some of the groups on the left hand of the slide to answer questions and to gather input on the program. One example of this over the fall last year, in partnership with the Minnesota Chamber Federation, we hosted 17 in-person events across the state and generated over 1,200 attendees. We brought along representatives from the Unemployment Insurance Division in order to support with the wage detail filing. But these sessions were really important in gathering feedback from employers early on in the process so that we can develop for them as well. So we're learning a lot from employers throughout the implementation, and that really is going to make a difference in the final product.
This is a nice little photo of one of the engagement sessions chosen totally at random.
I'm sure it was. Yeah, right.
Actually, I think the Wilmer session was the best attended session that we had. I'm sure the chair will be delighted to hear. Mm-hmm.
I hear about it all the time. Thank you.
Excellent. Moving a little bit into some of the technology and other implementation pieces. We're working to really build as one team, using best practices to deliver an excellent customer experience. So just to kind of give members a sense of how we're building this out, our development teams are made up of staff from the paid leave division, kind of setting product priorities, our colleagues at Minute at Deed, it's a Minnesota IT services, and our vendor, which is a firm called Nava PBC. Nava has worked with a wide variety of kind of benefits programs in providing really strong digital government services. We've established a product management function to support delivery alongside those partners. We've leveraged tools and kind of accelerators that the vendor has to establish environments and start development work immediately. And, you know, we've really developed an achievable roadmap to deliver needed experiences well in advance of the go-live date. We've gotten a number of questions just around testing and how, you know, kind of how, what does the process look like? You know, this is a deep field that engineers could spend literally days talking about. But I think maybe the way to think about it is that testing is a continuous process that ensures quality throughout the software development lifecycle. It's not done by one person or one entity. It's performed jointly by Minute, the paid leave team, and our vendor. And our implementation will also be reviewed by an independent auditor as well. You know, I've listed out a few types of the types of testing that are underdone. Each type of testing is really done for different purposes. Some are meant to prevent incoming cyber attacks. Some are meant to ensure that the application can meet, you know, kind of meet demand loads and under a variety of different circumstances. Others are, you know, just meant are meant to make sure that it's really easy and simple for a user to access it, whether they use a screen reader, whether that, you know, whatever type of, whatever way that they are engaging with the content. So just wanted to provide a few examples of this. It's a very comprehensive effort, and one that we take really seriously because a well-tested application is one that is ready for prime time. I know, you know, also wanted to make sure that we talked a little bit just about our approach to program integrity. You know, program integrity, like, you know, just like testing, is not one thing, right? It requires a multifaceted approach that includes risk management, payment integrity, internal controls. It's kind of a wide panoply of items. And we're going to use multiple tool sets and processes to maintain this throughout the life cycle of the program. There's no one magical tool or approach. It really just kind of requires constant vigilance and evolution because it's a dynamic landscape. But just to offer a few specifics around what's already been done. The program has written an internal controls plan. We've completed most of the formal risk assessments and fraud risk assessments. We are developing a team, a variety of policies and retention schedules developed as well. So this is absolutely at the core of what we are working to do. Also, just wanted to give a little bit of an update just on the overall org structure. I won't go through the org chart in painful detail, but we included it just in case it would be helpful for members to kind of visualize the way that we're organizing the unit. Really, you've got an administration team, a product team, an operations team, and a strategy team. So kind of thing, you know, kind of all meant to work in concert to ensure that we're delivering the program really well. Just in terms of hiring overall, the initial priorities of the division were focused on building out a strong management team, launching and operating a live contact center, driving that IT implementation, building program integrity into our core operations, building communications and engagement functions to prepare employers for the launch, and then managing the rulemaking process overall. And, you know, so I think the team is off to a really strong start in this regard. But, you know, we're obviously not done. You know, this spring and summer, we're really kind of focused on hiring up individual contributors to help deliver the program. You know, the majority of these 2025 hires are going to be in really operational roles. So your contact center representatives, the agents who will be adjudicating the claims, appeals staff, and additional program integrity staff to fulfill the functions that we kind of delineated earlier. One kind of early item, though, that, you know, we'd also note is, you know, just customer contacts. We are already, as you might expect, getting lots of questions from folks, and that's a great thing. We're really eager to engage with employers, mostly right now, and applicants eventually, as they have questions about the program, what they need to do to be ready. So we've already responded to over 1,200 direct questions from the public through the website, and we are building out a customer contact function over a year before launch. So today, it's primarily email-driven, but early this year, we're launching outbound voice and dedicated employer support, and then we'll have an inbound call center later this year as well as we staff up. We're trying to kind of match resources to the demands that that are coming in. So what's next in 2025? We wanted to just kind of outline a few of the key milestones, a few of them already complete. 2024, as Director Norfleet mentioned, public comment for rulemaking largely took place in the past year. First quarterly wage detail reports are in, and then the initial private plan guidance was published in late fall of 2024. This spring, we'll be opening up private or equivalent plan applications for employer exemptions. We'll be doing community outreach grants starting in July of 25, and then some of the employer notification elements take effect December 1st of this year. Then 2026, payroll deductions will start on January 1. Benefit and leave will be available to Minnesotans on January 1. Small business assistance will be available for employers starting January 1. And then the first quarterly premiums will be due to the department by April 30th of 2026. Just looking ahead to what the kind of roles are, you know, there's four really big important elements that employers play in the administration of the paid leave program. You know, reporting and premiums, obviously that's sort of the, you know, the payroll deduction and premium payments and then the wage reporting are essential to us being able to deliver the program. There's a really important part around education and information, workforce posters, individual notifications to employees. leave administration, you know, personal leaves can be complicated, and there's an there's a really critical role that the employer plays in coordinating the other leaves and the payments to employees who are on leave and supporting that return to work, which is so important. And then collaborating and improving, and I think Director Norfleet talked about this, but you know, this we are working really hard to try to build this for everybody, and we want to work with employers on collaborating how to operationalize the law and providing input on how we can improve over time. You know, employers, you know, the employer-employee relationship is a critical relationship. The employers play a really important role in helping employees learn about the program and how they access it and how we build an effective program together. Small employer assistance. Starting in January 26, funding will be available to support small businesses during an employee's absence. Leave administrators will be able to apply for funding once an employee is approved for leave. The qualifications in statute for this component of the law are that the employer has to have 30 or fewer employees, and their average employee wage needs to be under 150% of the statewide's average annual wage. So again, for using 23 figures, that would have been $104,000. The benefits are funding of up to $3,000 to hire a temporary worker, or increase in existing workers' wages for a substitute of an employee. And this is in addition to what Director Norfleet already mentioned under the premiums, and that small employers of 30 or under size pay a reduced premium rate under the existing law as well. Starting in July of 2025, grants are going to be available to community-based organizations to build capacity to provide outreach for paid leave, education and technical assistance for employees, for employers, and for self-employed individuals to increase equitable awareness and understanding and access of the paid leave rights and benefits, and learn how deeds outreach, education, and communications on paid leave can be improved. So in terms of staying engaged, check out the FAQs on our website. These are at paidleave.mn.gov. These items are updated regularly as we get new questions from employers and applicants. We have a very well signed up for a newsletter that sends out monthly content for, again, both kind of targeted both to employers and to applicants. We are eager to answer questions from employers and really anybody, through, and we have kind of an online inbound form for that. And watch out for upcoming opportunities to engage and provide feedback on program and product design. We take user testing really seriously. We really want to make sure that we're delivering a program that works for all Minnesotans. And just one more thing. We wanted to just show you an early look at what the application, kind of an early version of the application looks like. So if I can just play a little bit of a video here. This is an early draft of the paid leave bonding application. So, you know, kind of built in normal web design systems. It's mobile friendly and accessible. And hopefully what you'll see is that it's just a really simple, modern looking application. You enter your name, enter your date of birth. And I'll note that this will change over time and we're going to adapt additional functionality, but just wanted to show our work as to how it's going. So you enter your date of birth, you can enter your phone number, so that we can get in touch with you if there's an issue. Tell us the type of the phone. We ask for your address. And then we just ask if you need to add an additional mailing address. We ask if you have a driver's license or ID. This is for identity verification, as is asking for a social security number or an ITIN if an individual doesn't have an SSN. We ask, the law requires us to ask about gender identity and ethnicity for reporting purposes. But people do not have to submit it if they would prefer not to answer. We ask how you're going to get your weekly benefit. Then the law requires us to offer the option of withholding taxes if applicants want, so we ask that. We ask for your employer's EIN so we can match you to your employer so that we can get the, kind of pull up the employment record. It helps with the match. And then this is just that we ask what type of leave, when you'll be taking the leave. And, you know, obviously there may be some cases where you don't know, particularly for a medical leave. Those items are kind of, you know, each, there'll be a different flow for each type of leave as we go along. This is important. We ask if you've told your employer that you are taking leave. This is required under the law. And if you say no, we will ask you, tell you that you need to tell your employer that you are taking leave. For bonding leave, we ask how you're related to the child and then when the child was born. There's, of course, an option if the child has not been born because there's the opportunity to sort of proactively apply ahead of time. You can upload your birth certificate for your documentation. Check everything, make sure it looks right. And then hit submit, and that's it. Then the application information gets directed to the department so that the claims adjudication team can review it. And we provide kind of all the information that you've submitted. You can make changes in the application. You can withdraw the application if something changes. You can upload additional documents, and then there will be kind of a way to connect back with the department as the department starts to work through the claim. So again, this is early, this is early days, but we just wanted to give members a look at what this looks like. It'll continue to change and evolve as we work through it, but already I think you see hopefully what looks like an intuitive, mobile responsive application that will be there when Minnesotans need it. So that concludes our presentation, Mr. Chair, and eagerly look forward to members' questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. And again, Mr. Norfleet, thanks for going over the overview for us. I think I have a couple of questions. Members, please, jump in if you feel like you have any other questions. And we were on this, too, I can maybe address a couple of mine right now. On the presentation you just showed us about the employer notification, did you tell your employer you're going to go on leave or not, yes or no? Like we do with unemployment insurance, we always get copied on a claim that has gone in on unemployment insurance to verify that with the employer. Will we just be copied on a request when it goes into a leave of any kind? Does the employer just get copied on that like we do with unemployment insurance immediately, so we at least know something might be in the works if we don't know that? Mr. Norfleet? Yeah.
Chair Baker? Yes. We intend to inform the employer at the time of application. At the time that they tell us that they've notified their employer, that would kick off an email to the employer to let them know that an application has started. When an email application is submitted, we'd also notify the employer because we're going to ask them to help us verify the information provided.
And Mr. Norfleet, that would happen if the employee said no, they have not reported this to the employer as well?
They won't be able to submit the application fully until they attest that they have notified their employer, and we will notify their employer that they have attested that.
Got it. So, 'cause that will trigger that email to the employer right away, too.
Yes.
Thank you. I want to talk a little bit about the equivalent plan request, and I know that it sounds like that'll be open this spring. So again, if employers want to consider having an equal to program and not participate with this, what kind of a timeline will that carry? I understand there's a number of steps to go through to make sure that that person or that company is eligible to be waived from the program if they have an equivalent plan. If folks are right now waiting yet for the announcement of what the payroll cost will be, which is coming soon, I think is what we were told. Do we have a date yet on that, Commissioner?
Not soon.
Okay, still soon. But I want to make sure for folks that either have had a plan in place, businesses, what time do you need? Let's say they waited until November 15th to make a decision. How much time should they be told it's going to take to process a go or no go for their equivalent plan? Mr. Norfleet.
Thank you, Chair Baker. So we are working through the adjudication process with our partners in Commerce currently. The way that we're looking to operationalize the equivalent plans is twofold. First, if you're looking to purchase a private plan from a private carrier, we're looking to pre-approve those plans through the Department of Commerce so that we'll only need the control number as well as the signed plan documents in order to issue an approval. That process should take a matter of days. In the case of a self-insured plan, where an employer wants to use their own plan and they'll need to finance that through including a surety bond to the division, we're working through making that process as user-friendly as that experience. We are looking at the possibilities of a templated plan that employers could use in order to make sure that their plan complies with the requirements of the statute. We're working with the Department of Commerce as well on checklists so employers can pre-verify that their plan meets the requirements of the statute. So assuming that the plans come in the expected format, the turnaround time should be fairly quick.
Okay. Second question about sort of the unemployment insurance reporting and how that works. As I understand the program, there should be no reason why any employee should be receiving a double program benefit, i.e. ESST with paid family medical or unemployment insurance. First of all, is that a correct assumption at this point? And then I'll have a follow-up. Mr. Norfleet.
Chair Baker, for unemployment insurance, that is accurate. There is a prohibition from being able to receive unemployment insurance benefits at the same time as paid leave benefits. For ESST, we're working on guidance on this because it could fall into the supplemental benefits portion of the law where an employer may choose to designate a payment as a supplemental benefit to make up the difference between partial and full wage replacement. But if an employer does not choose to do so and an employee uses their ESST, it would be in lieu of receiving a benefit from the division.
So, Mr. Norfleet, am I hearing you still are working on that component of clarity with ESST, with paid family?
We're working on the guidance, and I don't want to get ahead of that.
Okay. And so making sure that it's prohibited from getting unemployment insurance alongside of paid family medical, other states have had problems there. There's been some fraud going on, in, like, for example, Washington State, using unemployment insurance. There was thousands of people were getting both benefits. In our world here in Minnesota, what is being set up to prevent anything like that from happening?
Chair Baker, we have an active partnership with the Division of Unemployment Insurance. We're working through our program integrity strategy, our internal control strategy, our data sharing strategy to ensure that that is not a problem here.
If I could make,
yes, Commissioner.
And if I could just add to that, I think one of the benefits of the way that we're working to kind of implement the program, so as Director Norfleet noted, we have the same wage detail back end and the same kind of tax and premium collection system. So having those, while the benefit payment systems will be different, having that common back end is really useful in terms of kind of program integrity from a variety of measures. And I would emphasize the kind of the really close nature of the partnership between UI and paid leave to make sure that those connections are built in and that they're being built in from the get-go. That's something that we take really seriously, and the statute is unambiguous in that regard.
A kind of a follow-up to that then, too, is, again, the NOR, name of the vendor again?
NAVA PBC.
Thank you. Is that a Minnesota company?
No, they're not a Minnesota company. They are a public benefits corporation headquartered in Washington, D.C.
Okay. Does the vendor that you have used for this sort of setup have also some guarantees and some safeguards that if they kind of mess up, we've got some guarantees because of their knowledge and I'm assuming their work on this program. Are there some guarantees of assurances, bonding type of things? I mean, I'm not going to keep going back to Minlars, but I lived through it. I was in deep into that. We didn't have a vendor to blame at that point. Here we have a vendor that you are working and we're spending a lot of money with to give us, I think, those safeguards. Are those kind of things built into sort of that contract and that understanding that if they miss a vital code and things go sideways, that they're there to back it up, Mr. Norfleet or Commissioner?
Yeah, I think there's a few different pieces that I could maybe speak to on that front. One is just making sure. I think as you note, working with an established vendor that has a track record of experience is helpful on that front, and that gives you some confidence going in. I would also say the way that the contract is structured gives the state lots of flexibility if things don't go as anticipated. So I think that's a really critical component. There's also, I think the state's standard terms have a wide variety of kind of professional insurance requirements, sort of other risk kind of pieces that are in place so that if the contractor makes an error, right, that would be something that the, you know, that would be something that the state could go after the vendor for. Naturally, it would depend on the specifics, but I think we've tried to, you know, working in partnership with the procurement experts at MINIT, Minnesota IT Services, and the Department of Administration. I think we've worked really hard to develop a contract with this vendor and really all our vendors that kind of provides the state flexibility, provides a lot of those checks and safeguards, and then you also have, you know, kind of opportunities for, you know, for overlapping oversight.
My final question, thank you. Of the different types of leave that we're offering, parental, active duty, et cetera, what kind of buckets, percentages do you find are going to fill into that? Is parental 40%, you know, with your estimates, is it medical it'll be higher? I'm just wondering if we have any data on that estimates early on, if that's available. I'm just curious about what we expect. And if that's not fair to answer, that can be a follow-up too.
I'd be happy to send some follow-up on the exact percentages. The overwhelming majority of applications long-term will be in medical.
Okay. Representative Bakeberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple questions for clarity. So one of the slides, it's titled Funding the Program. It says that employers can deduct up to 50% of premiums from employee paychecks starting January 1st, 2026. I think we all understand that. And then later, toward the end of the presentation, it says building paid leave key milestones. So under 2025, employers need to notify their employees about paid leave benefits by December 1st, 2025. So my question is, when are employers required to notify their employees that they will have a payroll deduction taken from their checks?
Mr. Norfleet.
Chair Baker, Representative. So in the statute, the requirement is 30 days following the date of hire or 30 days before premium deductions begin. That's where the December 1st timeline comes in. Each employer needs to notify their staff of the payroll deductions by December 1st, 2025.
Rep. Bakeberg?
So thank you for clarifying. So that's where that date comes from?
Yes, sir.
So I want to just give a perspective. So that is about 2-3 weeks right before a break in my school world. Many, many educators, frankly, and probably employees, they may not realize that, so there is a very high likelihood that there will be a shock to them on their January 1st pay that it's going to be less. So how can we rectify that? What are some things that are being talked about that you're hearing when you're out in the field in all of these listening sessions? How to communicate to employees that their pay is going to go down?
Mr. Norfleet or Commissioner?
I can take that, Mr. Chair and Representative. You know, I think there's a couple, you know, so I think one of the elements that the department is going to be working on to develop is kind of collateral for employers to share with their employees. And obviously the December 1 date is the date that is required in law by statute. There is nothing that prevents an employer from notifying their employees sooner than that. And we're certainly going to aim to have material, you know, the posters and those kinds of materials done, you know, well in advance of December 1st so that employers have access to those tools. So if they wanted to notify earlier, there's nothing in the law saying that they can't notify them earlier. That's just sort of the final date. So I think, again, we're working to provide things, you know, earlier so that employers that want to, you know, be more proactive on that front can certainly do so. But we also have to, you know, we just wanted to make sure that we called out the date that's required under the law as well.
Representative Bakeberg.
I appreciate that. So you said that posters or materials are being developed. Are those developed today? Are those completed, done, ready to go to employers? And here's why I asked the question, because many of our bargaining groups are coming and negotiating contracts. So if employ employ employees don't understand the ramifications of this coming, it's going to be a conflict point at the bargaining table for negotiations. So does the department have materials ready, or are those in development still?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's the materials, those types of materials are still in development since, you know, we are still many months away from sort of the employee notification part, but I understand the point about kind of the impacts on bargaining and those pieces, and I certainly imagine that that will be a subject of discussion.
Follow-up, Representative Bakeberg?
Yeah, and you made my point. We may be many months away from implementation, but our employees and employers are not many months away from collective bargaining discussions happening. So getting that information out would be very helpful to our employees so they understand what's going to happen. Because I can tell you many of the educators that I've talked to, many of the county workers don't understand that this is coming. They don't understand that if they get a 6% raise that it's going to be reduced by 0.44% right now. So getting that information out there, it is not good enough to say we're working on it, because we have to actually implement this stuff soon, today. My next question goes into the paid leave division leadership. So you have a flow chart or an org chart here. How many of these positions are currently hired? How many are in place, ready to go right now?
Mr. Norfleet.
Chair Baker, representative, the majority of those positions are filled today. I'm looking for the spreadsheet, actually.
No, I was going to say you should. Can we just have a second to pull up?
Yeah, that's fine.
If you don't mind. This one, just what's the total number?
We currently have 60 FTEs as well as 60 vendor staff.
Representative Bakeberg?
Was that 60? 60. Okay. FTEs that have been hired, and what is the target? Like, where are we? How many positions are currently posted?
Mr. Norfleet.
Chair Baker, representative, our target is around 400 FTEs. With the majority of those are going to be coming in classes from operational roles, so we'll be hiring large classes at once over the spring, summer, and fall.
And if I could,
Deputy Commissioner,
and if I could just add into that, you know, I think as we tried to share during the presentation, kind of the initial hire, a lot of the initial hires were sort of leadership, and then the and then folks who are focused on product development and product management. I think the sort of the long pole in the tent on this is implementing a lot of the IT and technological kind of process systems. A lot of the staffing that will be taught, you know, that will be kind of getting rolled into place later this year will be kind of large classes of people who will be taking in phone calls, you know, to the customer service center, as well as folks who will be adjudicating the claims, you know, and kind of going through those pieces. We don't want to hire those folks too early because they'd be kind of sitting on payroll and wouldn't really have any work to do. That'll be something that follows, as Director Norfleet said, kind of in the later spring, or not the in kind of more summer fall time period. There is naturally some lead-in going into 1/1/26 because we need to train those folks, make sure that they're ready to go day one. But that's sort of the, you know, there is definitely a ramp here because we're trying to balance making sure that we've got, you know, that we're being thoughtful stewards of the resources here while also making sure we're ready to go.
Representative Bakeberg, any follow-up to this question? Because I'm going to move on to the next member.
Just one more.
Is it to this question on the,
yeah,
on the employment? Go
yeah
ahead.
So just specifically, you said there's a ramp to build up, which I understand that. I understand there's some logic to, because I want to be efficient with our taxpayer dollars as well. So you said that there's a ramp building up. Do you have a specific timeline for hiring? In here it said, you know, it's spring, summer, fall. But do you have it clearly laid out, a plan developed, on the timeline for hiring? Or is it going to be this spring, going to be this summer, going to be this fall. You know, we're working on it. Is it specific?
Mr. Norfleet or Deputy Commissioner.
Chair Baker, Representative, yes, we do have a hiring plan in place.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I'm going to just kind of piggyback a little bit off of this space that Representative Bakeberg was talking about in relationship to, you know, he specifically speaks from an education perspective. But I was looking at the page and on the presentation that kind of talked about who you have engaged with. And absent from that, I didn't see any schools or anyone representing school districts. I didn't see anyone representing local units of government. So I didn't see any townships. I didn't see any counties. I didn't see any cities or their organizations. And certainly, especially for those folks who aren't or who don't have the ability to collect sales taxes and other things like that, this is going to work a lot differently for them. So can you please help describe for the committee what you're doing to work through these challenges for those employers?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, and I'll turn it over to Director Norfleet to provide a couple more details on this, but that list that we provided, you know, I would say that we have actually engaged with local units of government. From memory, actually, why don't you mention who?
Get the acronyms wrong.
That's okay.
Mr. Norfleet,
we have presented to organizations that are that for local governments, municipalities, as well as school districts. We recently presented at MASPO. As well. So we are continuing to engage. We have a public engagement request form on our website, which we review regularly for opportunities to talk to new audiences. We have had a number of conversations with municipalities specifically on how they're preparing for the law as well.
Follow up, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have additional questions as well. But just on this point, this appears to be a gaping hole that needs to be addressed because of how this has to be implemented with that group of people. Next question for you. One of the challenges that we have is that we have plenty of bordering states and employers and employees who are on both sides. What are you doing to address, or how is the agency handling cross-border employees and employers and any nuance that has to be brought to that conversation?
Deputy Commissioner.
Maybe just some initial comments. The law kind of sets out the definition of covered employment and has some of those geographic components. So I think, as part of implementing the law, I expect that we have or we will provide guidance on exactly how those items work. It's very comparable to unemployment insurance in that regard. Naturally, there are some differences because, UI is a different program, but, the covered employment concept is broadly similar. I don't know if there's anything you'd add to that, Chair.
Sure, Director. Representative. Yeah. This is the concept of localization. So it does depend on where the majority of an individual's work physically occurs. We are providing guidance in that. It's in our we do a monthly webinar with employers. The last one had over 2,400 attendees where we walk through how to apply the localization test to your workforce. We also part of the reason for the Greater Minnesota outreach was to reach out to border communities specifically because we do realize that there are unique challenges to that population. And we've had a number of really productive conversations with employers in those cities to help them make that determination on which of their employees are covered.
Follow-up, Representative Schultz. I just want to remind everybody we've got Zeleznikar, Wayne Johnson, Frazier, Greenman, and Meckland, and Pete Johnson on deck. So just go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief here. Thank you for that. I think that deserves additional work and attention to those employers and employees to understand. I think it's going to be additionally complex for everyone in that space. Question for you is, you are using and you kind of showed it in the presentation there with kind of that testing realm. Folks who are going to use this use their social security number or an ITIN number. Is this benefit going to be provided for people who are here illegally?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there is no requirement in the paid leave law that is tied to citizenship. Now, naturally, somebody, in order to qualify for the benefit, one has to have wage records of at least 5.3% of the state's average annual wage per the law.
All right. Representative Zalesnikar.
Half can go to the employer and then half to the employee for the 0.88 piece. But then there was a part in there with for small employers. Is that 75% of that 0.88, so is that a 0.66? And then they can split that? Or how does it, can you explain to me how that works?
Director Norfleet.
Chair Baker, Representative. While the premium rate is not finalized today, that general math does work. It would be 75% of the total amount that a non-small business would pay. That deduction is fully on the employer's portion of the premium. So where you would have the ability to reduce, let's just take it a hypothetical, is there a percentage you want me to use?
Just use 0.88.
Okay, so at 0.8, if it was 0.88, then the small employer premium rate would be 0.66. The employer would be able to take 2/3 of that amount from employee checks instead of half.
So basically the savings.
Deputy.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair.
So the savings, you know, it's up to the employer, but the savings could be fully captured by the employer. Right, so it'd be, you know, using that math, employer would pay 0.22, employee would pay 0.44. They could choose to allocate it differently if they wanted to.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you. Is there a system to educate the small employers on this part?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we'll be working through that as we get closer to launch, because we recognize that the premium is really important, and we want to make sure that it's very clear to folks.
Final, or otherwise I want to move on to Johnson.
Just okay. One more. Thank you. I just have one final question. There's extra funding. You talk about it on page, I don't even see it, what it is, but it's on the small employer for hiring temporary workers, funding up to $3,000, talks about that. My question is, has the department gave any thought to funding, extra funding for 24-hour operations for essential workers for EMS, firefighters, hospitals, nursing homes, where you have 24-hour operations that absolutely have to have staff? It's not a situation where somebody's going to be able to do somebody else's work in a controlled office setting. These are essential. So I'm wondering what thought has went into a fund for those type of settings to ensure a patient care is not compromised. Thank you.
Commissioner, and again, I just want to remind members we want to trade the technical side of this thing, too, not the merits of this. But go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think the law already kind of has a, you know, it's a provision for substitute workers. So I would think that if it's a, you know, I guess not knowing exactly what the situation you're envisioning, if it was a substitute for the normal operations of the business, I would imagine that they would be eligible for that, for that funding. I guess it kind of naturally depends on the specifics, but the purpose of that kind of small employer assistance part is to ensure that, you know, small employers have access to some funds for coverage based on the needs of their business. I don't know if there's anything you'd add, Director Norfleet.
I don't think there is.
Representative for Johnson, Wayne Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did I hear correctly, and maybe I thought I heard what I thought I heard, was that the premium is not set yet?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the final rate has not been confirmed yet. That is correct.
So we heard earlier, sorry, Mr. Chair, we heard earlier that there isn't going to be any more studies done on this to find out what the cost is. So if that is true, why would the premium not be set yet?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the administration's just making sure that we're kind of all clear and that we've got the right data in place so that we can make the right announcement.
So, Mr. Chair, who's making that decision now within deed that is, looking at new information that was not provided to the people who decided before what this would cost, now we have somebody else looking at it?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think this is primarily just about kind of finalizing and confirming the pieces that were discussed.
Okay. So
final follow-up.
We don't know how much it's really going to cost then, do we?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think we have the actuarial study. I think that there has been a lot of information kind of covered on this front. I certainly expect that we'll be able to provide clarity.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Deed. I'm really appreciate that we finally had the opportunity to have Deed come and present, and I think it's answered a lot of questions that were also shared during the testimony that we had last week from businesses. So thank you for bringing them in to do this, Chair. I appreciate that. I just wanted to note, this kind of goes back to, I think Rep. Bakeberg shared this earlier, around bargaining. That is where I spend a lot of time when I'm not here. And we put out many notices, bargaining alerts around this. So those bargaining leaders are well aware and ready to negotiate this at the bargaining table in the education realm. And I know that many of the labor groups in other areas have done the same. So I think, and I appreciate Big Bird raising it because I believe you care about our workers. And so they are well informed and ready to go with this. To the presenters here, can you talk about a bit? I mean, we've got 12 other states in the District of Columbia that have already implemented this. And with that, we've been able to learn a lot from what they've done. Can you talk about how we benefited from those other states in the District of Columbia that have already had this in place?
I'll maybe defer to
Director Norfleet.
Chair Baker, Representative. We have learned a lot from other implementations across the country, including successful implementations in Colorado and in Massachusetts. Some of the things that you will see are the really thinking about the role of the employer up front is a major innovation for the paid leave program here in Minnesota that creates a really contemplative engagement. Also using the unemployment insurance system as the primary premium collection system really reduces our risk of launching a large system and it comparatively has gotten over 160,000 employers into the system very early on in their implementation.
All right, Representative Frazier.
Thank you. Can you talk a bit about the rollout, the time period for the rollout? I know this came up a lot during debate when I carried the technical bill last year. Can you talk about that in terms of how this rollout compares to other states that have rolled it out?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the timeline that we've got is kind of in the middle of the timelines for other states. Now, naturally, the difference I think in Minnesota is that because this program was kind of pre-funded through by the 2023 legislature, it means that the kind of we are able to roll out both premium collection and benefit payments at the same time. Whereas in other states, they had to kind of fill the fund for that first year, and then they could roll out benefits. So I think that's kind of allowed us to move a bit faster. But I think given that we've had it's about a little over 2.5 years kind of from the May 23. Enactment of the bill to January 2026. I think we're in really good position.
Representative Frazier.
Just one more question. Well, we mentioned the idea or the fact that we're working closely with the U.S. system and we're kind of foundationally based on that. Is there anything more that employers have to do with wage detailing other than submit to the U.S. system?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, and I'll double check with Director Norfleet, but you know, as far as the wage detail piece, that's all kind of that's implemented, and again, over 160,000 employers have submitted their wage detail returns. In 2026, when premium collection starts, they'll use that same system to pay, you know, to pay their paid leave premium, much as they do today for UI tax. There's also going to be, you know, for employers who want to use an equivalent plan rather than the state plan. Additionally, there will be kind of, you know, we'll kind of have systems for that, for where they can apply. If there are employers who want to designate certain employees as seasonal, there will be kind of a workflow for that that will roll out later this year. And then additionally, there's going to be kind of leave administrative elements to it so that employers are able to kind of manage, you know, and kind of and work through those pieces. And anything you'd add there?
Chair Baker, Representative, the only thing that I would add is that for the vast majority of employers, there is no action required to be participating in the wage detail reporting. It worked for over 150,000 employers with no action on their own. A lot of our targeted outreach today is focused on folks that are not covered by unemployment insurance and trying to get them into the system. That includes municipalities, it includes religious organizations and groups that don't otherwise participate in unemployment insurance, and helping them set up a paid leave only account so that they can also participate in the program.
Thank you. And again, I think, do you have a follow-up, President Frazier?
One last question.
Yeah, and then we're gonna take a break because we've got a hard stop and I have a question along that, but we've got others on the schedule. We'll come back to that. So, Representative Frazier.
Yeah, just quickly, I know the question came up in regards to who has been engaged and not been engaged. When you've done your engagement outreach, there's no one, those meetings are open to anyone that wants to attend. Is that correct?
Deputy.
Chair Baker, Representative, yes, absolutely. We do a monthly webinar on Paid Leave 101 where we do take questions. We have an open form, so if an employer, anyone has a question they want to ask the division, we have a place for that. And any of the public meetings that we do, we really try to make them open to the public.
And
I'll leave it at that, Chair.
Thank you very much. And again, I want to, and to that question, to follow up, you mentioned the 160,000 employers that have already signed up. You're looking for the next line. Do you have in your mind what we need to get to say we've got 98% of the employers signed up for this program if they don't currently have UI? Is that just, I want to ask that quick question. If you have it, if not, I'll add it to my list of other members too down the road. So, Director.
Chair Baker, I think getting an exact number we would need to come back to you with, but we are confident that this represents the overwhelming majority of employers in the state.
Okay. With that, numbers, again, I want to thank our testifiers today from Deed. We've got Greenman, Mecklen, Pete Johnson, and Kozlowski on the list right now to finish this up, probably at a future date, likely next week, I think. Is that what our plan is right now? We're not sure, but we'll have you back. We'll give you a heads up on this for certain. And again, members, I apologize. We had to leave a little bit early today, but we've got you on the schedule for next time. Members, that includes our testimony and our hearings today. We are adjourned.